Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone, to the NIDS View, where deterrence isn't just a buzzword, it's our mission. It's me, Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder. See, Chris, I told you I'd put cows in here somewhere. Co-founder of NIDS, and I'll be hosting the show while Adam is still out on assignment and Curtis is probably goofing off, I guess. Who knows? Like everyone else, we're talking today about the government shutdown. But unlike everyone else, we're not here to count furloughs or close parks. We're here to examine how shutdowns shake the foundations of deterrence, disrupt strategic continuity, and send signals, intentional or not, to our adversaries. And to help us unpack this, we've invited someone who knows the machinery of government from the inside out, a former member of Congress representing the state of Utah, District 2, a national security advocate, and a valuable voice in our leadership team, and that's Chris Stewart. Welcome, Chris. I'm truly honored to have you on the show.
Hey, it's so great to be back. I used to join you guys more frequently. But it's been a while now, and you know, I missed it. So thanks for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And we're not going to run out of things to talk about. That's one thing we know for sure.
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. But before we get started, you know, you left Congress for many, many reasons. In our last show, we talked a little bit about that. Some associated with the kind of actions that are leading to shutdowns right now. I'm sure you really missed being a part of that.
Yeah.
But on a personal note, I know last time we talked, you talked about the health of Evie, your wife.
Yeah.
And I just was wondering for others to know, you know, how are things going? How's this working out?
Well, you're kind to ask. Thank you. So you're right. I left Congress a little bit unexpectedly. I'd been serving for about 12 years. And I was never going to be, you know, a kind of guy who stayed in Congress for 20 or 30 years. But I did have some pretty significant leadership positions. I was enjoying the work. Most of my work, not coincidentally to your topic, was on intelligence and national security. I was on the House Intelligence Committee, which is a very select committee and very important work for most of the time I was in Congress. I loved that. I was an appropriator, whose job it is to fund defense and to fund our government, which is directly relevant to the shutdown conversation today. Again, I didn't intend to leave, but my wife had a stroke, and we kind of struggled for about a year trying to make it work. But after a while, I just realized, hey, it's just not fair to her for me to be gone all the time. And so I made the decision to retire from Congress a little bit early. And it was the right decision, and we feel very blessed to be where we are right now. I tell you, though, James, people ask me all the time, hey, do you miss Congress? Do you wish you were back in Congress? And I'm like, dude, not for 5 seconds. I love the people I worked with, and I enjoyed the work, and it was important work. But, I mean, Congress is a very, very frustrating institution. And we're seeing some of that, you know, playing out, you know, beginning at 12:01 last night as we entered another shutdown. And, you know, I'm glad you're going to bring up kind of the national security implications of that, because there are some. But I loved my time in Congress. I loved some of the people. But, like I said, we feel very blessed. And Evie's doing well. So thank you.
Well, good. Yeah. And I'm glad to hear that she's doing well. And again, you know, I always say family first in our organization. Yeah. Before we get on to the topic, I just want to find out, are you doing, like today, were you doing congressional kinds of things at your house? I mean, what's it life like, you know, life like for, a retired congressman?
Yeah. Well, I wish I was retired.
Okay.
You know, because I left kind of suddenly, I really didn't know what I was going to do when I left Congress. I mean, normally you would think about it for a year or two, and then, you know, you'd announce in January, February, I'm going to resign after this term, and you'd have a year to kind of prepare for it. We didn't. We had a few weeks is all, really. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll be a greeter at Walmart. I didn't know, but a friend of mine, the former national security advisor under the first Trump administration, who I worked with really closely, Ambassador Robert O'Brien, and he and I spent a lot of time together in his office in the White House and with the president. And And he called me and said, hey, you know, why don't we work together on some government relations kind of work? And he pointed out saying, hey, what you're going to end up doing is going to be pretty closely related to what you did in Congress. And I didn't see it at the time, but it's since proven to be true. A lot of things I'm doing now are just extensions of what I was doing in Congress. You know, for example, I was in Moldova last week where they had elections coming up on Sunday that was really critical, as you've got Russia trying desperately to keep these former Eastern Bloc countries under their thumb. I mean, just exerting enormous pressure on those guys. And every time there's election, you talk about Russian interference. I mean, it's not just interference. It's flat out blocking and tackling and very, very heavy handed. So, you know, again, that's kind of similar to the work I was doing in Congress.
All right. Wow.
The only difference is I told you I was going to bring this up. I get to spend more time with my family. And I get to take good. Care of my cows up on the ranch. So life is good.
Well, that's good. Yeah, well, yeah, spending time with family and spending time with your animals. I know, you know, since I've retired, I spend so much more time with my wife and we spend so much more time with the grandkids. And that's part of being out of that position. But there's still work to be done. I do all understand also yesterday a big announcement came out about you. Do you mind you know, sharing that with the audience before we get on to the details of this shutdown?
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if it's a big announcement, but, you know, one of the things that I find myself doing is drawn into areas of work that are trying to bring technology and innovation to Secretary of Defense into the DOD. And so I've joined a group called Next Capital, which is focused on innovation and technology, and again, primarily for use in national security. So, for example, one of the things, and I've joined them as their strategic advisor, as example of, you know, a need there that's really quite interesting, I think, is one of the things that Next Global Technologies or Capital works on is anti-drone technology. Mm-hmm. I mean, Dr. Petrosky, one of the fascinating things we've seen from the war in Ukraine is the emergence of drone technology and how that's changed dramatically and how innovative the Ukrainians have been in bringing, you know, just, you know, bringing duct tape and wire and kind of innovating on drone technology. That's pretty remarkable. And you watch the war in Ukraine. I've been there, you know, multiple times, even since I've left Congress. It's like World War One. You know, married World War III, and they had a baby, because I mean, it's this trench warfare, this dirty, violent trench warfare where they're literally fighting over farmhouses and a few hundred yards of open field, while at the same time you have these first person drones, you know, flying through the trenches, chasing soldiers, some of them with facial recognition. So they're actually identifying leaders. And the drones are programmed to use facial recognition and to identify the officers and to kill the officers and not you know, the soldiers. And it's pretty remarkable how technology is changing the battlefield, is going to continue to change it. And the war that we hope to avoid in the South China Sea with China, but if that were to develop, it's unimaginable how technology will make that war very different than anything we've ever experienced before.
Wow. No, we'll have to have you come on a subsequent show to talk about that. I think that's really important as it changes the way that deterrence is, because that escalation ladder, you know, your ability to step in at any part of the warfare at a fairly low cost and at a fairly effective, you know, capability with drones, et cetera, really make it more important to fight for that stability. Well, you know, before we go, I just want to thank you. I'm sure Congress misses you, especially on a day like today, probably misses your voice and certainly misses your vote as the Congress goes. So they miss you there. But thank you for being a part of us. So let's go ahead and get started, because I want to talk about this shutdown because it was relevant for today. And I was glad you found some time to talk with us about this and inform our audience, because I really want to know what the shutdown means from our security posture. So let me open by saying my Petrosky view. And I say that jokingly, because I'm not really affiliated a lot with government. I've worked in the government. I've always felt myself as a low-level person. I always tried to ignore what was really going on at the higher levels and focus down instead of up. And I always thought that the shutdowns were more of an internal issue, that the outside doesn't really care, the other countries don't care, our adversaries don't really see it. And it's more of a political posturing within our country and the way that just government's going to function. But I will say, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, Chris, for a bit, is that, you know, I remember most of my military career up through the mid-90s, October 1st was a fun day because our budgets got released on time and everything happened the way it was supposed to. And we anticipated that day. The only thing you had to do is spend your money by the day before, which was really the issue within the government. And those days are long gone. And it's really made a difference in the way that things operate. So let me turn it over to you to talk about that sort of external, internal influence, Chris.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I recognize, and it saddens me really to hear you say about, you know, the mid-90s when you and I were both in the military at the same time, or working with the military. And you're right, it's not something we considered. But as you said, those days are long gone. We might be able to get back to a normal funding the government process, but we won't unless we do significant reforms. And so far, no one has the stomach to do those reforms. And by the way, they're not terribly hard or terribly difficult. We could fix the process, but so far we just can't get support for doing that. And you're right too. A lot of people think of the government shutting down or partial shutdown as being kind of an internal thing and not affecting, you know, most government operations, which it really doesn't. All essential operations continue. But I can promise you this: today, right now, as we speak, somewhere in the world, China is talking to either business leaders or government leaders, diplomats around the world, and they're looking at and pointing a finger at the United States and saying, look how dysfunctional they are. I mean, they're a broken form of government. They can't even figure out how to keep their own government over or open. Is that who you want to associate with? You want to associate with that kind of chaos? And China is looking at pointing a finger at themselves and saying, we don't go through that. We fund our government. We fund our Department of Defense. And I promise you that somewhere in the world right now, there are Russian leaders who are pointing at the United States and going, what a mess. You know, pointing to European allies and saying, what a mess. So it does have an impact. I mean, part of it is political. As I've pointed out here, to say that our adversaries will use it to point out our weakness or our dysfunction. And look, I get it. I mean, democracy is a very, very difficult form of government. And it doesn't operate perfectly or even smoothly all the time. Still, as Churchill said, it's still the very best alternative we have. But our critics and our enemies will point that out. But there's this as well, Jim, and that is, shutdowns like this are very, very hard on our national security and on defense. It's very hard on contractors and people who are working and can't continue to work if their funding is paused, which it is during the shutdown. So if you're a company, a young emerging company like I'm familiar with, that's working on AI on how to predict and to prepare for, say, maintenance on very sophisticated aircraft like the F-22, that work stops today, and they can't continue that work. If you're a company that has to build munitions, that work stops today, and they're not building the munitions that we'll need. I mean, I could go on and on, but there is a cost when the government is dysfunctional like this, and the majority of that cost is borne, unfortunately, in our national security and defense.
Yeah, it's interesting how the government, you say, you know, most essential pieces of the government operate. And I'm always a people person. I always look at, you know, how are people affected? How is the operation affected? I recall, you know, in the past when there were government shutdowns and we were told you can't go to work, you can't do your job. And I know government workers get a lot of bad rap, but most of the people I worked with, they wanted to skirt the government rules and find a way to work from home or work, you know, meet offsite and go do things that keep things going because they were passionate about what they did and they realized the importance of it. And it seems to be disconnected with the national leadership at times in seeing how that affects people. And it really does take the air out of the balloon. And from a deterrence standpoint, you want people to be innovative and interested in wanting to do that. When you went through these processes, how did that play into any of this? Or was politics completely immune to that that effect on people? How did that go?
No, politics isn't immune to that at all. You will feel those pain points. And we went through 4 government shutdowns when I was in Congress in the 12 years I was there, all of them initiated by the Republicans. And in every case, we ended up conceding. We ended up coming back and funding the government. And I don't think in any case did we get the thing that we were fighting for. And I think that's almost inevitable that that's what the Democrats are going to end up doing. And part of the reason is because of what you just said, Jim, because there are pain points. It does exert a cost. And it's important to point out in this case, I mean, this is actually pretty simple. The Republican language is simply what they call a clean CR, continuing resolution. Right. It's simply saying, hey, we should fund the government while we continue to work through our disagreements over spending priorities. But let's just fund the government. No other riders, no other policy statements, just a clean CR. Let's just fund the government. Everything status quo. Chuck Schumer, on the other hand, in Democratic leadership is saying, no, we're not going to fund the government unless you do this and this and this. And I could say what that is, but it doesn't really matter. But it's hard to win the argument of we're going to shut the government down unless you give us what we want. And the American people generally don't support that. They generally don't think that these budget battles should be used or shutdowns should be used to win on policy initiatives. So, I mean, honestly, I think that I would hate to be a Democrat trying to justify this right now, but eventually the pain points that you talked about, people not being able to work, contractors not being able to work, the Pentagon, everything, all their programs put on pause, those eventually begin to grind, and the political leaders have to respond to that. And whether it's in a day or 2 days or in a day or 2 weeks, eventually I'm just confident that will happen, that they're going to be forced to reopen the government and get things going back.
Yeah, you talk about pain points. I was curious about how, because you work so much on the international basis, and you spoke of our adversaries primarily about Russia and China, but what about our allies and how they, you know, how they work, especially from an interagency standpoint, from agreements and treaties that we have? You know, this has to have some sort of impact there. Is that another pain point that we see? And how does that, how again is our, you know, I'm always looking at how we keep peace and how we keep prosperity and stability. It seems like this is extremely destabilizing with our allies as well.
Well, it is. And the primary reason, I argue, and I think this is right, the primary concern is that it weakens their faith in America just functioning, right? Whether we like it or not, we are the leader of the free world. We have been for 100 years. And I understand, believe me, I came from a military background. My father was a pilot in World War II. Oh, yeah. Five of his sons served in the military, and you know, half a dozen or a dozen of our children now. So I get the pressures and the extreme demands we put on our military. So I'm not advocating that we are the world's police, and we should be. But I do advocate for this reality. The United States has to lead. And the world looks to us for that leadership. So one of the primary concerns is our allies look at us and go, well, those dodos over there can't even keep their government open and functioning. Now, they know, most of them, that, you know, we'll resolve this in a relatively short amount of time, but it still kind of weakens our position of leadership and their trust in them. The second thing is most of them are struggling with a lot of the same things. We don't really hear about it as much, but all of them experience exactly the same friction in funding their own governments and getting their priorities. So they're not entirely unsympathetic to the position we find ourselves. But then there's this last thing, and you keep coming back to it, and I'm glad you do. But that is, you know, we have certain agreements with our allies. We have certain security agreements. We have some partnership agreements where we're providing, you know, training or, you know, weapons and munitions And all of that is interrupted when we're in this position. So that has direct impact on the allies that we have around the world that we depend on and that depend on us.
Yeah, imagine it slows things down, too, in terms of information flow. And, you know, when you talk from an intelligence standpoint, I know that's a touchy subject. But even the information flow and things that happen, you know, I went out and looked, and maybe you might know differently than me. I went out and looked. I always think of these things as being a time of vulnerability. And maybe it is. I've never seen that we've been, you know, we're vulnerable, yet anyone's taken advantage of it. I mean, what's in place to keep these vulnerabilities from, you know, getting out of hand? Let's say that, you know, today's the first day of the shutdown. That's why we're recording this today. I'm not sure we're going to see about airing it a different day from our normal pattern, just to get it out there into the public. But, you know, let's say this goes on for 30 days or 60 days. You know, what assurances are built into the government system to make that happen? I mean, has that been worked through as well? Yeah, I worry about a 9/11 kind of event occurring when we're in this kind of a, you know, sort of a disagreement. Or is that just, again, politics? I'm so far away from it, I don't quite follow it that way.
Yeah, so it's important to keep in mind. By the way, it's a great question, and it's the one thing that everyone wants to know, right? Are my mom and dad going to get their Social Security checks?
Yeah.
You know, is the FBI going to keep investigating crime? Are these federal agencies going to stay open? Is our military going to get paid? And the answer is to those, yes, yes, and yes, because they distinguish between essential and non-essential. Okay. So our military is doing everything that they normally do. Our law enforcement is doing everything. DHS, it's not like you don't have ICE agents who aren't continuing to, do the essential work that they need to for border enforcements, et cetera. All of that work continues. But, and this is a significant but there are implications for it. For example, if you rely on contractors, for an easy example is for munitions, that's probably interrupted. It's probably paused. If you're relying on regular government contracting process for the things you need to do your mission, that's probably impacted. So while the work continues and the essential people continue to do their job, on the backside, it's harder for them to do. And you said, you know, maybe a month or 2 months of a shutdown. We've never experienced that. I mean, the longest shutdown that I'm familiar of, and I think this is probably ever, was, I think, 32 days.
Yeah.
And that was a real aberration. Most of them are a couple days to a couple weeks, maybe. And I think that's probably what we'll see here. But having said that, found out it's a crazy world, right? And things that you thought, oh, that'll never happen, it turns out, you know, they do. So, but I still say with really a high degree of confidence, this probably won't last more than, I'd be shocked if it goes more than a few weeks.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting take on it. Again, you know, I try to stay in the news cycle at all ends, and you hear everything, because you're right, it's a big unknown, which, you know, unknownness always, you know, leaves you open to all kinds of persuasion, as well as, possible, you know, people taking advantage of that. And I think that's a piece of this as well. You know, I've always looked at that. Some of this disruption, if you will, is just part of being a democracy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you don't have this happen in Venezuela, right? It's not the same there. And so, you know, I've talked to some political scientists who say, well, you know, democracy, this is just part of the process, and shutdown's another tool. But I find it that, again, going back to our lives, up until the mid-90s, this wasn't, you know, almost pro forma. I mean, I remember my comment, I think when they passed the CR earlier, I said, they're just pushing it down the road, and we're going to have another shutdown over this in one of these two cycles. Yeah. And sure enough, it's happened. That's not me being, you know, I'm just a scientist. I look at the data and go, that's where we've been. Yeah. You know, what, from a national standpoint, how do we gather together to work this out? I know it probably was your big frustration in Congress, like, I can't solve this problem that seems to be a national security issue. But, you know, what kind of things make this different and still we maintain a democracy? Because, you know, the flip side of that is you don't have a democracy and people can't don't have the tools to push back and, you know, sort of work things out where everyone gets a little bit of what they want. And that's sort of the way the, you know, the democracy works. Everyone gets a piece, or a republic works, I'll say.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's actually quite a lot to unpack in your comments there.
Yeah. Sorry.
So let me address a couple of them just briefly, if I could. Number one is I agree with the political scientists and other people that you talked about that this is just one of the tools. It's kind of recently been implemented, but that doesn't mean it's, you know, it's devastating to use this tool. I don't think it's helpful and it's not effective. That's for sure. Is again, people who initiate government shutdowns don't win the arguments, and they almost never, in fact, to my knowledge, never actually get what they want out of it. But hey, it's a tool of democracy. So I got to tell you, of all the things I worry about, even this morning, this shutdown wasn't one of them because we survive them and it takes a while to catch up. It's hard on DOD, but generally we catch up and things are okay. So I don't think it's a demise of our nation that we go through this, but it's not healthy for our nation. And then the second thing is this. You know, again, your presumption that when you and I were younger, the government would fund itself from year to year, that does worry me. I mean, and this last year is a good example of it, where we operated on a continuing resolution for the entire year. Under the first year of the Trump administration, when he had Republican majority in the House and the Senate, and yet for that entire year, we operated under a Biden administration budget. I just think that's bonkers. So that does worry me. And the third thing I would maybe add, just to give context to all of this, is there are meaningful policy and philosophical differences in the United States right now. And a lot of those differences are sometimes eventually the struggle comes down to, well, what does the government think is important? And how do you know what the government thinks is important? What does the government fund? And so these aren't really, in a lot of cases, just funding questions. They're deeper than that. I mean, again, you're choosing the priorities that the government and the society says this is important, this is less important. And so it's not just counting pennies. It really is a much, much deeper battle taking place here. And so that, I think, when you know that, that, you know, that the battle is philosophical as well as political or very practical dollars and pennies, it gives a little bit of understanding about why these battles come back every year. And they will come back every year as we kind of go through this struggle of what is, you know, what do we as a society believe? What is important to us? What are our priorities? And, you know, we're battling through that pretty much on a daily basis across the spectrum of issues.
Yeah. Now, you know, you said that you know, you can see what's important to the government. What's most important is how it gets funded. You know, I've always said you can tell what's important to the government by how the nation votes, because, you know, the nation votes. But we are very, you know, almost every election is so close, and, you know, there's no landslides, there's no big issues that we tend to all agree on. And it's almost as though we, in some ways, we're losing our national sense of, you know, of being as a, you know, again, a 200-year-old experiment as a republic that's worked very well. I'm not saying we're throwing it away, but I do get concerned because it allows pressure points to exist that make us change. And the external, going back to the external, it allows external influences to sort of push that among our society. And from a deterrent standpoint, again, always going back to my bread and butter, and that is that how do we make sure that this doesn't lead us into a point where we're so disheveled that it's easy for someone to walk in and take over? I mean, that's, you know, you can go back to, I always go back to the CIA manual. I've gone back and read, it was written in the late 1950s, in which the government said, if you really want to bring down another country, these are the things you do. And some of the things, you know, poor manufacturing, people not working, people not having a sense of value, you know, internal strife and struggle, then you get the government to do that. And over time, that weakens their stance. And it's what you talked about initially here. I see some of this now. You know, it's not all bad. We are a strong country. We have a strong constitution, and it tends to always pull us back together when we really need it to. But the shutdown here just becomes a quick reminder of the fragility of our strength. And So, to that end, I look back at how we respond to all those things, and how our internal legislative, what our legislators look for on both sides. I'm sure they're all looking for a way to make it work out the right way. Yeah. So when you're in that position, when you're looking, where do you look?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of the question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And, you brought a whole lot of things together and simmered it down. And that's basically what we're going through as a nation, and what we've always gone through as we've grown and as we've changed. One of the things I love about our country is we have grown and we are better. I think we're better people. We went through a dark time when we allowed slavery, but at some point we said, look, this isn't morally defensible. We shouldn't do this. And, we had this great civil war in which you had, a huge, huge impact on our nation. But we worked our way through it. I mean, the civil rights movement, where we said we're not treating everyone the same, and we should. Our Constitution says that everyone is created equal, and we're not doing that yet. And so, I mean, one thing I love about our country, and it's not just in racial politics, it's in a lot of things, where we really have grown. But at the same time, we're not perfect, and at the same time, we have things that we've got to work through now. I do think there's two or three things that are true, and in some cases, they appear to be in conflict, and they are, but they're not mutually exclusive. The first thing is that our founding documents, the Constitution, and the principles that they represent are far stronger and more endearing or enduring. Well, actually, I'd say both, endearing both. And enduring. And some people give them, expect. And I think, like you said, we come back to that, and it's the thing that binds us together. The second thing is we are and have been and will continue to be the greatest nation on earth. I don't think Russia can, Russia cannot destroy us. I don't think China can destroy us. And I think that's true even if we're in the midst of government shutdown. We'll be okay with this. The third thing is Abraham Lincoln warned, it's not a foreign country that will occupy and destroy the United States. United States ever fails, it will be because of internal turmoil. And I think we're experiencing that today. Those are the kind of the things that, very large strategic ideas that I think are all true and that we're grappling with right now. But I believe we'll get through this. We'll certainly get through the shutdown. I think we're strong enough that China may criticize us and laugh at us and try to convince people that they don't want to be like us. But a lot of people around the world look at the U.S. and go, I do want to be like them. You don't see mass migration to China. And even if they allowed it, you wouldn't see it. We still are the light of the world, and we'll work our way through this.
Wow, no, that's a good point for us to end on, sort of where I wanted to land, because I do agree there's a positive end to this because of the structure of who we are and who we are and how we identify as a nation.
Yeah,
and we're out of time, and we're going to close out this episode. But Chris, I didn't know if you want to have any final words before we closed out, but I just want to say we've covered so much, and there's so much more to unpack here. But your insights are just incredible because, a lot of times, as I said, looking down and then looking up and seeing how the government functions, it's great to know that we have people like yourself who have served and were willing to serve, and you're still serving us in many, many ways. And I want to thank you for that. But I'll give you the last word before we close it out here.
Well, my last word would be just to say thanks. I'm very familiar with what NIDS does. I've been involved with it and for a couple of years now. And what you're doing is important. And it's an honor to be able to spend a little time with you, talk about these things.
Well, thank you. And on that note, hopefully when this show comes out, maybe the government shutdown is already over. We'll find out when we air. But if not, you've heard at least from us that it looks like it's not all doom and gloom, but it is something that we have to grapple with. And I think that the view of deterrence and the strength of our country comes from the values that we've placed in it and the way we've structured ourselves. And so without any further ado, Chris, I thank you again for being a part of NIDS, for all you do for our country, certainly for coming on the podcast today. Hopefully we can have you on more often to hear some of your wisdom and background. And you promised you'd talk about chasing cows, but you never did bring it up.
No,
so I'm going to bring it up here at the very end. So we'll talk about it. Well, maybe we'll do a farming episode sometime.
We're up on the mountain last weekend on horses trying to find our cows up on the mountain, and we can't find 11 of them. So I'm going to go get some drones and go look for
them. Yeah, there you go. If there's farmers around my place that actually do that to find to find various things. So with that,
thanks, James.
Yeah, with all that fun in mind, I just want to thank our listeners. I want to thank our many sponsors of our organization at NIDS. If you're a listener and you found this exciting, go out and find a friend, a colleague, a group, whatever, to listen more to our podcast. The more we have listening, the more we can get sponsorship and the more podcasts we can produce. And so with that, I want to end this episode with telling you, as always, we want you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.